Right, good morning. We'll be starting just about a minute or two, continuing in Koheles. And we're picking up in chapter 2, about verse 13. And we'll just start about 1 minute. Once you hear the audio, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen if you're joining us online. And if you'd like to join through the phone conference, just feel free to send an email to office@mesorah.org, and we'll send you the information as to where to call in and the access code. This way, if you want to ask questions verbally as opposed to typing them, by all means. Okay, Joel, thanks a lot for the confirmation on the audio. Interesting area that we're taking up, and just in terms of the appreciation of the text itself, and how just slight nuances really open up the area. But it has to be that way. I mean, it's God's wisdom, so there's a tremendous amount to be gleaned from every single verse. Just even how words are slightly altered, and the sequence of the verses, you know, and we'll show that today a bit. And hello to you too, Joel. Hope everything's going well this week. Morning, Doug. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Thank
you. Good morning,
you.
Rabbi.
Hi, how are you?
Looking forward to the class.
Okay, thank you. Let me know when we're ready to go, Doug.
I think we're ready. We got a whole gang on the phone.
Okay. All right, so we, just to recap, last week we were discussing King Solomon's approach, where he left off from going after objects and possessions and building palaces and great wagons and objects per se, and then he proceeded to examine lifestyles, not looking to amass wealth or objects or experiences, but now he was analyzing lifestyles himself. That's in 2:12, where he talked about how he would ponder the value of three different areas: wisdom, a life of wisdom, a life of just play, which would be drinking, and then the life of acquisition of building and possessions, all right, which we just talked about as being work. So those three: wisdom, play, and work. And he said in verse 13, that's 2:13, that he saw that there was a benefit of wisdom from, in contrast to binyan, building or acquisition. And he said that benefit is equal to the benefit of light over darkness. And that's how he ended that verse. So it seems to be a conclusion that wisdom outweighs the life of just building and acquisition. And we said a lot on it. Just one more point, and why it is. And we touched on it a bit. We said that wisdom is really, let's take the working. Why is building or acquisition or accomplishments or trying to seek happiness in that area, why is that something which is problematic and doomed to failure in and of itself? So we said there that the person's projecting onto reality his wishes. He feels that he has some notion, and therefore he follows his notion, but it's not something which is checked, and it's not something which he's really determined is the truth. So in the process of building an empire, and under the assumption that this will now give me happiness, it, number one, it's unexamined. Number two, because it's unexamined, there hasn't been any relationship shown between that assumption that this activity will result in a sense of happiness. So it's a projection. Whereas wisdom is the opposite lifestyle. It's not where you're projecting values and assumptions and you assume that now this is going to result in something. Wisdom is a life where you're perceiving, you're not projecting. You're now using your mind and you're studying and you're absorbing and you are taking in as opposed to projecting outward false ideas. Here, with wisdom, the mind is designed where you can observe natural phenomena or philosophy and study psychology, and you now become a receptacle, we said. And that that activity of receiving new ideas and seeing new insights is an enjoyable activity. So that was one thing which we said. The difference between the life of accomplishment and chasing after that, and we said that's really what your current day businessman does, you're climbing the ladder of success. So that's the wrong, maybe it's a ladder, but it's not success because he fails to get happiness. That's why he has to try another activity. And he has to, Doug, you had mentioned last week that the people who are in business, they tell you that how do you get happiness in the working world? You keep on setting new goals, is what you said, which shows you that the first goal really didn't achieve anything. That's why you have to have a second goal. But if a person would stop and think, you realize, well, if it didn't work the first time, why is it going to work a second time? It's like taking a key, putting it into a door, it doesn't open. So you take the key out, you say, well, I'll try it again. Now, after a couple of times, you know it's not the right key. Why stick it in a 10th time, an 11th time? But that's exactly what they're doing. Okay. But one more insight into that before we move forward is that the concept that these people have, not the concept, but the false notion that they have, that this climbing the ladder of success will now produce happiness, if they would study it, they would realize that it's really not, there's no, it's not really affecting man. When he has that success, where exactly does he say that happiness comes from? When he buys things, or when he rises to a new position in his business. Where is the improvement on man? It's external. Those things are really external to the person. When he makes a building, when he gets a new position. A position is really nothing real. A position is a label that somebody tells you, you now have this status. It's not anything real. It's not tangible. It's not even something which is, it's, if I could walk over to a person and I tell them, you're now the President of the United States. If he believes it, he can feel good for a moment. If he actually had the position, very good. But we're talking about where, you know, within a business structure, let's say, person has a certain status. You now have your vice president, your executive. You put the executive in front of the word vice president. Now, ooh, that's something more. But that has not changed who he is. You see what I'm saying? It's not a change, really, in any way. It hasn't reduced his cholesterol. It hasn't removed any of the ailment. It hasn't toned his muscles. It hasn't created a new way of thinking in his mind. I mean, any real benefit is not there. It's his fantasy. A person now thinks, oh, I now have this label. I now have this status. So I'm just trying to show you how those successes, or if you make a building, or you create a new company. So where is that affecting you? See, that's the fallacy. The person doesn't realize that there really is no effect. It's two separate things. Whereas wisdom, when you learn something new and you see a new insight, your mind develops. Now there's a real change to you as an individual. All right, we didn't say this last week, so I just want to show how if a person would think about it, he'd see. It's like what happens in China right now has no effect on me here. That's basically like if I make a building and I put my business name at the top of the building and it's the highest building in the world. Well, you know, that's what somebody said, I think it was you, Cal, you said about the building in Dubai, or it's the highest building and they don't want to release how tall it is, but it's, you know, all the praise. It's all the talk right now, as if that really means anything. It doesn't. But people are trained to think that a building is something since the world expects it. You know, respects it. You see, that's what they did also in the Tower of Babel. It's not a new phenomenon. They said, let us make, we'll make this tower, we'll make for ourselves a name. You see, even there, back then, man has not changed. The exact same human psyche. But you see how central the concept is that the Torah even has to mention it. Because the Torah doesn't mention every single event in history. It's impossible. It's a limit, you know. So it's a limited book, and the events, you know, spanning so many, you know, billions of people over thousands and thousands of years. Just, but the Torah highlights those which are crucial lessons. Okay. But King Solomon did conclude that that wisdom is better, which now brought us to a big problem. Because the very next, that was chapter 2, verse 13. The very next verse reads as follows. Now let me just read 13 so you see clearly. Because he says that I'm going, in 12 he says, I turned and I looked at wisdom and drinking and accomplishment and building, and I saw, what is man? And he comes after the king, after all has already been made. And again, what we said on that last week was that if a person would really take the idea to this full extent, like King Solomon always does, he'd realize that the attempt to accomplish and to build, he's severely crippled, because he could only work within the substances that exist on earth and the laws that exist. Outside of that, he can't be creative. He cannot do anything more. He's limited. So the attempt to accomplish and to do new things and to make his mark, how can he do anything when God really is the one that set up everything in play? So if a person would realize that, that should remove him from that area in terms of looking for that alone. I mean, a person does need to have a sense of accomplishment. That's why God created it. But if that's all he's looking for to gain happiness, then he's going to be dissatisfied. And King Solomon is explaining why. Because there are certain limitations, severe limitations. So what can I do? God's really the one who's the real inventor, the creator. So that's why he concluded, and that was verse 12. In verse 13, he concluded that I see that there's benefit to wisdom over acquisition and building, that type of a lifestyle, just as there's a benefit to light over darkness. Okay, so that sounds like he made a conclusion. But in 14, he says like this, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool travels in darkness. And I know, yes, I know, he says, also I know, that one occurrence will happen to all of them, to them both. And he continues. Interesting. It's interesting. Why doesn't he tell you what that occurrence is in that verse 14? No, he goes on to another verse, which we'll come back to. Why is it separated? But look what he says in 15. He says, and I said in my heart, as is the event, the same exact word he used in the previous. He said, it's sort of like he's repeating himself without there's no reason. He says in 15 now, and I said in my heart, as the event visits the fool, so also it will visit me. Therefore, why have I become wise anymore? meaning any more than the fool. And I said in my heart that this is a futility, that this is really nonsense. And he goes on in 16, he says, for there's no remembrance to the wise man with the fool forever. Bishakavar hayam ha'mabayim, as the days will now continue, all will be forgotten. Hakol nishkach, all will be forgotten. And how can it be that the wise man dies with the fool? And then he concludes this thought in 17, and he says, therefore I hated life, because it was evil upon me, this whole labor, this whole doings that is performed, that happens under the sun, because everything is futile, and it's a vexation of spirit. Okay, so that closes that thought. He moves on to another topic after that. Not an unrelated topic. He talks about something, but we can stop at this point. You see how it concludes. So the first thing we notice, again, is that if you already sit in 13, that wisdom far surpasses a life of ambition and building, just like light surpasses darkness. Now, if that's true, how could he say in 14 that the wise man's eyes, and he even starts off by saying that the wisdom, you know, that the wise man's eyes are in his head and the fool goes in darkness, just like he said the previous verse. But then he says another thing, but he says, no, but thinking about that, I know that one event will happen to us both. And then he explains what that event is, and that, I believe, is the Mitzvah's Dove. He's talking about death. We talked about that last week. That one event is death. So then what use is it that I became wise more than the fool? We're both going to die. It's both going to end. Okay, so that's the one question I'm asking you now. How can he first say that the root of wisdom is better, but then he says, no, because this is event of death, so now, I mean, didn't you know about that in verse 13? Right? Everybody have the question?
Rabbi?
Mm-hmm.
So, don't we have two things going on here? We've got what happens during your life, and then what happens at the end. And so the second part he's saying at the end, the same thing happens to both, and we'll have to discuss that. But it seems like it's fair for him to say the life of wisdom is better than the life of achievement while you're in it, because the life of achievement is kind of this treadmill of futility that never ends, because you never get the satisfaction, whereas while you're alive, when you get the wisdom, you do have satisfaction.
Well, I mean, while you're alive is even at the end of your life, you still have the same quality, you're still alive. As a matter of fact, you're wiser.
Right.
So why is it that he's saying in 13 that wisdom does surpass ambition and building, but then he says, despite the fact that the wise man's eyes are in his head and the fool lives in darkness, I know that there will be one event that happens to both of us, and therefore why did I become wise? Meaning to say that somehow disqualifies it. Where is the disqualification? From what perspective is my question?
The question is kind of making the assumption that the life ends with death.
Right. As opposed to what?
As opposed to, you know, a world to come.
Right. Okay. So that's what he's doing in 14. He's bringing in a concern, and of course, you know, the King Solomon knows about the world to come. So, again, I keep on repeating it because it's very important that he's vocalizing the thoughts that a typical person will have. Not that he believes this, but this is how he gets the reader to identify and admit to these notions as being really true notions that I believe in. by the king saying it, and that allows me to say, yes, I feel that way too. So he allows the person to admit, to raise these unconscious notions to the conscious, and or the subconscious, we should really say, or preconscious, we should say. Meaning it's not unconscious. The person knows about it if you tell it to him. But it's not on his mind all the time. It's just something which is underlying and something which is, you know, eating away at him. But you'll notice that in verse 13, when he talks about wisdom, it's about wisdom per se, and the life of the faculty or the attitude of sichlus, of building and acquisition. Look at the word, the first word in 14. It doesn't say wisdom anymore. Now it says the wise man. What's the difference?
They're talking about how he's perceived by the rest of the world as opposed to his own actual experience?
No. I think that what it's talking about, for example, you see, he says, he talks also in 14, he says, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool in darkness goes. The word goes, or travels, is not in verse 13 either. It's only in 14. Then he also says, I know, also I. It's a funny thing, that one event will happen to both. What does he have to bring that in for? He's saying, I. The comparison is, or we should say the contrast between these two, is that 13 talks about wisdom per se. 14 talks about the person, the wise man. So inasmuch in 13, where he concludes that wisdom is better, so that's because we're talking about an absolute abstract truth. The abstract truth itself is what the subject is of 13. Wisdom surpasses a life of ambition or foolishness. However, he's speaking to human beings here, and people are, there's experience, and there's a certain, the self comes into the picture, it changes everything. So what he does, he switches from talking about wisdom per se, and now he talks about, well, what about the wise man? Now when you bring this down into the person's life, so now we're talking about the individual who is wise. We're not making an assessment of wisdom versus acquisition and accomplishment and building. That was 13. In 14, he's talking about people. Ah, now once you bring this, it's true. I can think about wisdom and I can assess it properly and give it a high, much higher status over of the life of ambition. But now what happens is that a person is always reflecting on the self. So it's true that the wise man has his eyes in his head and the fool goes in darkness. That's true. But now you see, when he's talking about goes in darkness, holeth, now he's talking about the earthly phenomena. He's no longer talking about the abstract truths. Now he's saying, now let's plug this into an experience of a person on earth. Now what's going to happen is that it's true the wisdom is better, but now there's a conflict. Because now, that's the first half of 14 talks about, you're right. If I plug in wisdom and foolishness, you're right. The wise man has his eyes in his head and the fool goes in darkness. However, he says, I know, also I, that one event will happen to both. Now when I look at this, like you were saying, Josh, and I plug it in to the framework of my earthly existence, now it comes up a new consideration. I'm no longer just looking at the abstract assessment of, is wisdom better than a life of building and accomplishment? That's for sure. That's clear. We're looking at just the abstract truths of wisdom compared to building. So there's an absolute statement that wisdom surpasses it. It's like light. It's like a light and darkness. But since a person is human and he has emotions and he plugs in and he now has experiences, now what happens is that the self gets involved. That's what he's telling you in 14. In terms of the abstract truth, you're right. That's 13. Wisdom is it wins. But now what happens is that there's a thing which is disturbing, and that is that it's great. Wisdom is fantastic. However, when the self comes into the picture, when it now becomes convoluted, now he's trying to expose a flaw in the human experience, and that is that a person will not be able to separate the abstract truth of wisdom compared to foolishness, and he always brings it down into the self and says, well, I'm going to die, so what good is it? See, that's the error. He's trying to show you how when I bring it into the personal framework, and now I plug it into the self-image, and I become part of the mix, now you're going to end up with a false notion, because the person just crossed the line. In order to assess wisdom, it has to be the abstract assessment. But if you make the mistake, and now you start talking about people and the earthly experience, so now you're going to convolute your assessment of wisdom, and you're throwing something into that assessment that doesn't belong. And that is the fact that there is death. What does death have to do with the wisdom? It doesn't. But that's what a person does. And he makes the false assessment. And he says, one event is going to happen to myself and to the person and the fool. So that's the first step. He wants to isolate that in 14 and show you a step that the mind makes. That's what he breaks it out in a separate verse. Then he tells you the next verse, 15, he says, then I said my heart. See, he didn't make a negative assessment on wisdom yet. He just showed you in 14 that there is a step that's being made where the person will not just look at wisdom alone anymore, but now he brings it into his personal framework about life on earth. And now he sees there's a conflict. He says, this wisdom is better than foolishness, yet I see that there's death. He doesn't make a value judgment yet until the next verse. The next verse, he says, now I said, because of this, and I said in my heart, because of this, when this event happens to the fool and to me, now I made a cast of aspersions on wisdom. And I said, why did I become wise any more than this person? And this is a futility that I wasted my time doing this. But that comes subsequent. So therefore, King Solomon is not only showing you ideas, but he's showing you a process that the person makes psychologically. It's a psychological, it's a couple of steps. The first step is 13. I see that there's wisdom, it outshines. Literally, it outshines. Well, not literally, but he's saying it's like light compared to darkness, so that's why I'm saying that. So he said, wisdom outshines foolishness. But then the psyche, the person makes a step. And now it plugs it in. Well, how's it going to benefit me here on earth? See, a person traps himself and he keeps on limiting, and that was Josh's point. A person keeps on limiting his assessment just to the earthly phenomenon. And now that's where it becomes convoluted, and that's where the mistake is made. The first step. So he isolates that first step. He doesn't give value judgment until the next verse, because he's just trying to show you, in 14, he's trying to show you the error. The first error that the person makes is that he brings in the self into the equation when he's assessing wisdom. That's a mistake. You want to assess, you know, for example, if you're in zoology, you're examining a zebra, and you're trying to understand the unique features of it, so you don't say, well, I don't like black and white stripes, therefore a zebra's not a good animal. You are left outside of the assessment. You're completely invisible. You're transparent. You are looking at certain characteristics of the animal or any phenomenon in nature. It would be foolish. A scientist had a student that they were studying the zebra, and everybody's understanding it. And one student says, well, I don't think that it's the right animal that we should study right now because I don't like black and white. I'd rather study a colorful animal. So he'd be laughed out of the room because that has nothing to do with objective study. That's exactly what the person's doing here. The person made a correct assessment, you know, King Solomon made a correct assessment in 13. But now he vocalizes the poor step that the person makes in 14, where it brings the self into the picture. It allows that, and allows personal considerations to blur the value, or to mitigate the value of wisdom. So that's the step in 14 alone. He doesn't make the assessment, the value judgment yet, because he just wants to show you the step of of the kind of illusion of the mind. Then he brings in the final step, which is how the person makes a wrong assessment. And he says, well, since there is this death, so now wisdom has to be useless. That's what he says in 15. All right, and that's what he says also in 16, that there is no remembrance for the wise man with the fool when the future comes. And how can it be that he's forgotten? Right? He says, everything is forgotten. And how can it be that the wise man will die with a fool? Meaning, how can it be that, what do you mean zichron? A remembrance takes place where? It takes place on earth. So I just want you to see how the ridicule is limited to the earthly sphere. Okay? That's why he brings in remembrance. He's saying that there's another problem here. There's not even going to be remembrance. He's looking, he's grabbing for straws. Where is there some benefit? So maybe we both die. Maybe the fool and the wise man both die. But maybe there is some way to salvage the wise man by saying that he's remembered. He says, no, even that isn't there. You see? The person's looking for some last of a vestige of the self, that somehow. But that's a false idea, because you're not even here. Why would that even benefit you if you're not here? But it's a false, another foolish attempt of the ego to try to look for some satisfaction. Maybe I'll be remembered. People have this, they live their lives doing things, so I'll be remembered. I'll go down in history, whatever it is. But he says, no. Later on, future comes, who even remembers you? That's not there either. And that's why he says in 17 that I hated life because this matter was evil upon me under the sun. Under the sun. He underlines that. Under the sun, meaning if you just assess everything based on your earthly existence, then you're going to have a false conclusion that it's evil and it's a vexation of spirit. And that's how he closes off this area. Okay, let me stop if there's any questions or comments. And Joel, this is chapter 2. All right, we just read from 13 through 17 in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. All right, let me pause here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Makes sense.
I liked your metaphor with the zebra.
Yeah. Right? I mean, a person, it's a foolish thing. But that's what the person's doing here, too. If you isolate wisdom and you isolate accomplishment and building and acquisition and you just look abstractly at them, then you can appreciate. But once you bring it into the self, which invariably happens to people that are just not clear thinkers, their emotions are running all their actions and their assessments. Their value judgments always end up being decided from the wrong angle.
Rabbi, if given the analysis that was just made, then I'm a little confused by when we get to verse 17 and even 18. So he says, so I hated life. And then in 18 he says, I hated all my achievements. So it almost, I mean, it sounds like he's there, not that he's saying, okay, this is a mistake that people make, and the real analysis involves the world to come. But it sounds like he's actually going through this himself.
Yeah, he did go through it himself, to use himself as an experiment for other people. And he examined, he was, as Rabbi Chait said, he was both the subject of the experiment and the observer. But he said, Rabbi Chait said, only King Solomon could do it. But he doesn't bring in. He ends off on a negative note because he's trying to show you that if a person makes the assessment based on quote-unquote under-the-sun phenomena, earthly phenomena, then yes, you'll end up with this type of assessment. And when he goes on to 18, now he talks about a new idea. He's looking again. Well, maybe I can leave things over to somebody. And maybe there'll be some worth over there. We'll have to go into that. I didn't analyze that yet, so I can't respond to 18. But it appears that he's going to a new emotion about bequeathing things to somebody else. Maybe I'll gain some satisfaction in that. But then he shoots that down. Well, who knows if he'll be foolish and he'll rule over all my work. That's a subsequent to this. It's additional, I should say, not subsequent. But the idea here is to show you the steps that the person makes and where the error is. See, that's what he says in verse 14, and I know, also I know, it may be that wisdom is good, but I know that there's going to be some event, meaning death, that's going to happen to both me and the fool. So when I am now part of the assessment, that's why there's a problem. That's where the problem starts. That's the error. I just want you to see that you can really pull this right out from the verses. And that's really how the Torah works. That's how the Torah is designed. And we see that again. When he first spoke in 13, he was talking about wisdom per se, the subject of wisdom. But in 14, he talks about the wise man. Once you plug it into the human being, the human experience, that's going to be a different type of thing. That's where a flaw can arise. All right, and the other clue also in verse 14, he talks about that the fool goes, he travels in darkness. Meaning traveling is an earthly phenomenon. So once you bring this out of the abstract and you plug it into an earthly phenomenon, now you're going to be convoluting your assessment with, number one, the flaw that Josh mentioned, that you're assessing things purely in the closed sphere of just your earthly existence. So there you'll conclude, well, if we both die, what use is it? What benefit was there, all this great wisdom, if we're both dying? That's a flaw, that's a mistake, because that is not the end. But that has a very strong pull on a person, because a part of a person is convinced that it's the end. That's why there's a fear about death. So see how he moves through, and the hints are right in the verses, but he's exposing the flaw. First, there's a step of removing the analysis from just purely the abstract assessment of wisdom versus folly or acquisition or wealth. That's really where you should make the assessment, but the person makes the flaw, and now he plugs it into how he interacts with it. And that's what we said about the zebra. The person cannot give an accurate assessment of what a zebra is if he now projects onto this whole assessment his personal tastes in color. That has nothing to do with zebra. Chaim is just writing on screen that in our generation we can capture our visual experiences and our thoughts and deductions on DVD discs carrying this into the future to satisfy our egos. Yes, that's what he's talking about over here, about a false notion that there a person might, I mean, there is a definitely a genuine good thing about that, to be able to share your memories, to look back on your life. But if a person is doing it for the wrong reason, that he's trying to, for example, what King Solomon says in verse 16, that there's really no remembrance of the wise man. That means it's something else a person is looking for satisfaction. We touched on that he'll be remembered somehow. So that's the ego. That's why he talks about the ego as well in 14. And I know, he's talking about the self. The self becomes a part of an equation which really should not belong to. The self should not be in there. All right. Anything else? Right, but I think the first point that I opened off is just to reiterate that the big mistake of the businessman climbing the ladder, and he's going through a process of projecting fantasy and assuming that that is real. And in fact, what he's doing is just fabricating, and it has no effect on him. He's fabricating ideas, and it really is not going to affect him. Whereas wisdom does affect the very central part of the person, his soul, his intelligence. So therein lies the reality that that's why wisdom is something which far surpasses it, because it's like light and dark. There's nothing. Darkness is nothing. There's no effect that building has on your happiness. The fantasy may be lived, you know, short-lived. The wisdom, that really changes you. But again, this world is a sensual world, and people want things that are tangible and that are motivated by ego, and he's looking for the applause of others. And I was actually talking to a friend last night, and he was expressing he felt bad that he is not president of the United States, he said. And so we were talking a bit about it. He was brutally honest. He was like, I said, but what is that going to help you? When you're dying, you come before God, is God going to ask you whether or not you were the president, or is God going to ask you if you were involved in studying him? I mean, the president is just the opposite. It's where you're looking to be the most central figure and in front of the cameras as much as possible. It's purely motivated by ego, hidden by altruistic, you know, ostensible altruistic motives. But and the tremendous amount of energy and amounts of meetings and toil, and you don't have the time where you could sit back and take a few days off. You've got to be on call. And he liked that idea. He liked the idea of being the president. He was actually on track, and he was going to go to law school, and it really bothered him. He said when Obama became president, because he went to Columbia, and so did Obama, and he had a very high grade score, and he could have gone down that path, and it was a troubling thing for him. But that is, you know, that's the really ego just in its full blown form. And he's actually motivated. He showed me pictures, and he met a lot of different, you know, celebrities and high position officials. Perhaps in some way that gives him some, you know, sharing the spotlight emotion. But again, we have to keep our values not on how people are going to look at us and how our self-image is going to play out. And again, that's just a fantasy. To think that is how, I mean, a person can't sit around all day thinking about his position. A person is a vice president. He can't just gain happiness from contemplating his position. I am vice president. You can't think about that all day long. It's a dead end. Now what? You have to do activity. You have to be involved in the pursuit of things that will enlighten you. That, hey, that's an interesting idea. That's what really can satisfy a person at the core. That's how we're designed. But we're fooled by the bright lights and the cameras and the flashes going off, and look how much attention he's getting. That must be a real high. There probably is a high to that, and there's probably many, many lows too. And there's also a limit. I mean, even if you're president for 8 years, it comes to an end. Now what? Now you have to start begging to get speaking engagements to get back into the spotlight. And maybe the Secret Service that are escorting you for the rest of your life that does something. But you're relying on people to get your happiness. It's a funny thing. You're trying to say you're important, at the same time you're so important, why are you dependent? Independence is really a greater level than dependence, but a person who's a star or in the spotlight, that is a dependent state. Well, you need to have others. So it's sort of like you need them. They're important to your life. It's a funny type of thing. But you see, it's a very strong thing. And that's what King Solomon's mentioning over here, that the ego is really always at work. But, you know, we have to look at the wisest men and see what their ideas were. And look at this, King Solomon, like, you know, the same role as a president. What was he involved in? You know, photo opportunities? No, he was involved in examining the self and trying to help out. It was really, you know, he was the best, you know, servant to the people by using himself as an example and exploring and trying to show people these flaws that you make look, I tried it out. I tried all these lifestyles. I tried amassing all these objects, but it didn't play out. It didn't work. Okay, and Chaim is mentioning that passing on, you know, imagery, photos to the future is a gift to future generations. Yet, as long as it's looked properly, it's a good thing. I agree with that. And Joel, you're writing that also businessmen have to keep spending to climb the ladder. That's true also? They have to keep on staying in the ladder. It's never an ending thing. And what's great about wisdom, you're not dependent. You see new ideas. You could go open up a book. You could be on your own by yourself. And they say, you know, in Pirkei Avos, that the greatest thing for a wise man is silence. So this way he's involved in thought. Because if you're talking, you're not thinking. And if you're distracted by external stimulus, again, it distracts you from being able to ponder ideas and arrive at new truths. And what is it really that God wants for us here? And what's really going to give me the happiness? I mean, we have one life. We should really be very, very concerned that we use our days wisely. So that means study. And that means quiet time, thinking. And this is something a person could do and really grow. Independent. Okay, any questions or comments?
No.
Rabbis, when you look at the Psalms, your metaphor of the light and the darkness, could that have something to do with this idea of projection and how you know, if you're walking in the light, you know, you see reality. But, you know, if you're walking through, like, a dark room, you have to kind of imagine and project, you know, there's a wall here or, you know, there's something, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I actually thought about that. I'm glad you mentioned that. I was actually thinking about that. Because when you're in a dark room, you're imagining what might be there. It's an active projection, exactly. It's very good. Whereas when it's light out, now you're receiving information. That's why it's a very good metaphor. Very good observation, Josh.
Okay.
All right, any questions? That's pretty much what I wanted to discuss for today. So if there's any questions you have, got a few more minutes. It could be, you know, this topic or this something else.
Rabbi, I will just add a thank you for your recommendation last week about, you had mentioned Genesis and the Big Bang by Gerald Schroeder. And although I haven't been able to get a hold of that one, I was able to get a hold of his two other books, one of which I've started, and they are very fascinating.
Which ones are those?
He has one called The Science of God and one called, the latest one is The Hidden Face of God. And they all seem to be combinations of bringing, you know, if I can use the word religion and science into harmony.
Right. Good. I mean, share with me what you find. I haven't read those. So I'll thank you for your recommendation on those. And if you see some very interesting ideas, you know, communicate them to me. I would love to hear them. I really think he's a brilliant, brilliant person, writer, and just you know, there is a lot that obviously I'm not a scientist, so there's a tremendous amount that he writes that I just can't understand because you need a lot of prior knowledge.
Yeah, in The Hidden Face of God, he was able in about one paragraph to at least provide me a reasonable understanding of what E equals MC squared actually means, which I've never understood before, so.
All right, you think you could repeat it?
Yeah, I mean, he's basically saying that what we see as matter, you know, tables and everything, is as we know, there's more space in there than there is real stuff, and that it is all basically energy, and that was Einstein's idea, that the energy of a particular mass, or particular object or a mass of an object has a certain amount of energy of which it's composed, and that there is just as much energy in a gram of rose petals as there is in a gram of uranium, and that that amount of energy is measured by taking the mass of the object and multiplying it by a constant, which is c squared, and the c is the speed of light. So it's the speed of light squared times whatever the mass of the object is produces the amount of energy in it. And he commented that he had personally witnessed the detonation of 6 nuclear devices, and that he suggested very strongly that we all pray and work for peace, because the amount of energy just stored in those single atoms, of course, is phenomenal. And I think the premise of the book, where he's headed, is that what physics is beginning to see is that when you go below what we see with our eyes and get into the molecular structure and so forth, that even below that, all of matter and all of existence is based on an idea and a wisdom that is very unified. And he ties in, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, into that, and explains that it's one, not in the sense of after that comes 2, 3, 4, but in the sense of unity. And he brings out a very interesting point, which he says may be a coincidence, but it may not. And that is, at the end of the creation in Genesis, when it says, I forget the exact quote, but at the end of the 6 days, it talks about things being one. And he said, Onkelos, when he translated the Torah into Aramaic, didn't use the term one, but used the term unified order.
Really?
Yeah.
When he said when it was good.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Cal's reminding me. It was when God saw that it was all very good.
Uh-huh.
And he apparently didn't use the term good, or he translated not as good, but as a unified order, and that it was unity and order that apparently determined completion.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just getting started in this, and it's just a fascinating thing to contemplate from sort of that angle.
Well, I'll have to get a hold of that. That's called the Hidden Face of God.
Hidden Face of God. It's available in paperback, so you can get it at Amazon or through probably any bookstore.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very interesting.
Hey, Doug.
Yeah.
This is Pamela.
Hi, Pamela.
Does it also kind of talk about Newton's laws as well? Because if you're going to start going into C equals MC squared equals MC squared, you should probably also look at the laws of entropy and stuff like that.
He does touch on Newton a little bit, and he's probably going to get into it more. I'm only about into the second chapter.
Right, because that whole unity thing might also kind of touch on things like natural disorder versus order, which you'll probably find really interesting as well.
Yep.
All right, very good. I'll have to check into it. Okay, so I think we'll wrap it up for today. We'll pick up next week. We're going to start with, I think we're up to verse 18. All right? And if you have any more insights on that, Doug, please, feel free to share that next week, too. I'd like to hear more about it, all right?
Okay.
All right. I'll see if I can hold the book there.
Yep.
All right. So, everybody, I wish you all a good week.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay.
Wonderful. You too. Very enlightening.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Have a good week, everybody.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.